Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley. This is the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate, creating conversations that matter every Saturday afternoon here as part of Faith Explored on Premier Christian Radio and listened to around the world via its podcast too. If you want to find out more, go to our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and you'll find lots of links there to other interesting things. The Unbelievable book, the Unbelievable conference coming up on Saturday the 19th of May too. Early bird tickets still available through till the 16th of March. So do get in there now if you want to come along to this year's conference at the early bird price. So many great speakers, so many great topics at this year's conference. You'll be able to understand your Christian faith more fully, discover how to answer tough objections, and engage in creative ways to share Christ with others. All done in association with our conference partner this year, Reasons to Believe. Some really fantastic topics as well. I'll be telling you a bit more about them later on in the programme. Do book in now, though, for our hashtag Just Ask Unbelievable Conference 2018, Saturday the 19th of May, at premier.org.uk/justask. You're unbelievable. Well, I'm really looking forward to today's edition of Unbelievable because we're going to that big theme, Jesus mythicism, and we're talking to one of the biggest players in that field, Richard Carrier, on the programme today. He's coming on to debate, did Paul believe in a real or a celestial Jesus? This is going to the core of Richard Carrier's thesis on why he doesn't believe Jesus was a real physical flesh and blood human being. And we're going to hear him explaining that in the course of today's programme. Richard Carrier has been on the show a number of times with me before debating this and other subjects. But it's good to revisit this. And Richard Carrier, really one of the foremost voices in the Jesus mythicism movement today. And then it's good to welcome back for the second week in a row, Jonathan McClatchy, who joins me on Unbelievable today. Jonathan, as you heard last week, if you were listening then, has various interests, including intelligent design. But he turns his hand to all sorts of other things too, including issues around the historical Jesus, the reliability of scripture and such like. And he runs something called the Apologetics Academy as well, which he'll tell us about, I'm sure, in a moment's time. But you can find links to both my guests from today's show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Let's talk to Richard Carrier first, who joins us on the line. Richard, thank you very much for making time for today's show. Remind us again, for those who haven't heard your previous contributions, how you got into the whole rather interesting area of Jesus mythicism studies.
Yeah, I actually was adamantly against Jesus mythicism for quite some time throughout graduate school. What happened was some people whose opinions I respected said that there's this one author that you should read. There's a lot of terrible authors out there who write terrible mythicism that's, you know, factually incorrect and fallacious and has ridiculous theories and so on. But they said you should read Earl Doherty. And so I read Doherty's book and I realized, like, well, okay, he's got a decent theory. It's actually a defensible theory. What is the response to it from the historicist community? And there really isn't one, or hasn't been one. And that left me to be like uncertain then, like maybe an agnostic, like 50-50. And then eventually, when the economy collapsed, my fan base developed a postdoc research grant for me to do a research project on this. So I developed several books, got the major one through peer review, arguing that one in three chance that Jesus did or Jesus existed, which is, you know, not a certainty that he didn't exist, but I think on balance, the probability is that he started as a revelatory being and was transported into history a lifetime later.
We will ask you at the outset, once we start the discussion today, to lay out that thesis in a little more detail, obviously. But I think it's worth acknowledging, I think as you acknowledge, that the view you hold, the mythicist view, is a minority view. And in that sense, you're, as it were, presenting the case against what many people believe is the obvious fact, whether they believe he was the Messiah or rose again or anything like that, that someone called Jesus of Nazareth did exist and did things that to some extent were recorded for posterity. And so, I mean, do you often find people are simply dismiss you out of hand because of the views you hold? I know that you have had some pretty big run-ins with various New Testament historians over the years, even the non-believing ones, as it were, you know, people like Bart Ehrman and so on. I mean, is it a difficult position to be in, the one you hold?
Yeah, certainly. What surprises me is how adamantly everyone refuses to read the peer-reviewed book that I published on this. It's like, well, at least read the peer-reviewed literature, like have an informed opinion on it. And that happens a lot. I'm really surprised by just their adamant refusal to do that. They just dismiss it out of hand, literally, without actually, let's look at this. Let's actually debate the possibilities. Let's consider this. Let's add this to the list of theories, because there's a whole stream of contradictory different views of the historical Jesus and the origins of Christianity. This is just one of many, and I think it deserves a place to be debated amongst all the others.
Well, it's time to introduce our other guest on the program today. Jonathan McClatchy returns. Jonathan, this isn't your prime area of specialization. We kind of did that last week in a way. But what's led you to get so involved nonetheless as a layperson in engaging with these issues around the reliability of scripture, the existence of Jesus, and other such arguments?
Well, I'm very passionate and enthusiastic about having a well-informed, intelligent, evidence-based and rational Christian faith. So as a Christian, I believe that I'm a Christian because Christianity is true. And so I'm very interested in examining the evidence very carefully to look at the reasons why I'm a Christian and also some of the best objections to the Christian worldview. So I'm actually very grateful for people like Dr. Richard Carrier to present some of the most rigorous arguments against the Christian faith so that we can see exactly where the balance of evidence lies.
Of course, in a way, Jesus mythicism is increasingly well known because of the phenomenon of the internet, which mm-hmm. which obviously allows these kinds of positions to be broadcast widely. And there are kind of communities that sort of gather around that, in a sense. And in a sense, you're doing the same from the apologetics side. You've got the Apologetics Academy, which is a regular sort of, I guess it's not Skype that you use, but there's a sort of way in which you gather lots of people in one place online to hear from some of the finest, both people against Christianity and for Christianity, people like Richard and others who you invite on to hear their arguments and then discuss it in this sort of webinar style.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, my paradigm has always been that if Christianity is actually true, we have nothing to fear from hearing the very best and well-informed critiques of the Christian worldview. So I've had people like Bob Price, who's another mythicist, on the webinar a couple of times. I've also had David Fitzgerald on, who's a friend of Richard Carrier's. And I've had various prominent philosophers and scholars, including Dr. Stephen Law and others as well.
Rather like this show, which has very much the same sort of approach, that we shouldn't be afraid of engaging, you know, some of the strongest objections to Christianity and meeting them head on. So if people want to do that, and it is kind of, as you say, it's kind of like taking apologetics to the next level. It's a very in-depth kind of treatment that you give it. Or in the Apologetics Academy. If people want to find out more about when webinars are and who's coming up in the schedule and so on, where should they go?
Right, you can go to www.apologetics-academy.org and click on online apologetics training. That'll take you to the upcoming schedule. We use a webinar platform called Zoom, so we live stream on Facebook, and we are able to accommodate up to 100 participants at a time.
It is amazing what you can do now. It's so easy these days to hear from the top quality people in these fields. Literally from wherever you are in the world. That's the benefits of the internet. It's also the challenge, in a sense, because I think, Richard, a lot of people kind of lump you in with what might be called fake news. You know, anyone can propose any kind of a theory about, you know, the moon landings were faked, and, you know, the 9/11 disaster was some conspiracy theory. I think a lot of people think of Jesus mythicism in the same way. What's your response to that?
Well, I mean, really half of it is. You have someone like Joseph Atwill, who's advocating like ridiculous conspiracy theories about the Jesus mythicism, that really is like moon landing reasoning. And so there is really, on the internet, it really does spread. There is a lot of this bad information and sort of what I'd say crazy theories of mythicism. I think there is a disciplined, more serious version of mythicism that can be argued. And that was really first hit upon by Earl Doherty, and then I've developed it into the first peer-reviewed defense of this position. And one does have to distinguish between those two things. There is a lot of, like you said, the crazy internet version of mythicism. But then there's also the serious academic version, which strips away all of the stuff that's implausible or excessive, speculative, and so on.
Well, I'm really looking forward to what we're going to be doing today. We're going to be diving fairly deep. It's a little bit of a warning for the audience as much as anything, that we're going to be going into some depth in terms of the scriptural analysis, the historical analysis, specifically focusing, though, on the Apostle Paul and whether he actually believed in a real flesh and blood Jesus or a celestial Jesus, the kind of Jesus that Richard Carrier says that was actually the foundation for the Christian story. So we'd be interested in hearing your responses to anything you hear on the show today. unbelievable@premier.org.uk is, of course, the email address to send those into. You can also find us online via the social media and leave us your thoughts that way. @unbelievablejb on Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievablejb if you'd like to get in touch via Facebook, follow us that way. All of those links and more, links to my guests and today's programme, the ways to share it on, listen to the podcast, all at the show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So did the Apostle Paul believe in a real or a celestial Jesus? That's what we're asking today, because one of the foremost Jesus mythicists in the world joined us on the program today. That is Richard Carrier. And he's when he first told me about this thesis, when you came on, I think it was with Mark Goodacre several years ago, Richard, when you happened to be in the country at the time. I must confess, I myself did, and I guess continue to feel, unpersuaded. I felt, this sounds so far-fetched. It sounds unbelievable, to coin a phrase, this idea that Jesus never existed, and all of the writings we have from the Apostle Paul, from the Gospels, well, they're either much later sort of fabrications, or they are references to a purely spiritual celestial phenomenon, or what they believed was a spiritual celestial phenomenon, not to a flesh and blood Jesus. So I'm going to have to ask you to lay this out in a little bit of detail now, so that we can hear what Jonathan has to say to it and see what others think of it. So go ahead. This is your chance to lay down your thesis.
I mean, at first we have to correct that the defensible mythicist thesis does hold that Paul believed that Jesus became flesh and blood, that he acquired, in fact, literally Jewish flesh, that he actually acquired a mortal body and died in that mortal body. But the view of this particular version of the origins of Christianity holds that actually took place in a mythic realm, not actually on earth, not in Jerusalem, etc. And in that sense, it tracks very similarly another savior cult in a neighboring province, which is Osiris cult. And we have from Plutarch where he actually says that in the Osiris cult, they had tales where Osiris is an actual historical person and his death and resurrection take place on earth. But he says that those are allegories for the real story. What actually happened is that Osiris acquires flesh in the lower heavens, and then he's killed there and then resurrects. And then this gets, in that version of the religion, it gets cycled year by year. But the point being is that there's this celestial version of acquiring flesh and dying, and then there's the earthly version, and the earthly version is not true. It's just an allegory for the cosmic things. And we have a lot of that stuff going on with ancient savior cults in general. So when we're looking at a savior cult like Christianity, we have a lot of similar characteristics, baptismal initiation, you have mysteries, you have fictive kinship where everybody's calling each other brother and sister, you have the equivalent of communion where you have communal meals, and you have this idea of a personal savior. And the personal savior God always undergoes some sort of passion. Literally, it's the same word in Greek. Sometimes it's a death and resurrection. Sometimes it's something else. And Jesus looks like basically a Jewish version of this. Everything that's different between Christianity and these other savior cults can be explained by looking at the Jewish side of it. That this, they've imported a lot of Jewish ideas and changed things up to make them, more Jewish in their characteristic. So when you look at this, we know all these other savior gods didn't exist, and yet all of them had tales about them, placing them in history in some form. So on Earth history, I mean, in some form. So what we need is more evidence that Jesus is different from all these other savior gods, that he uniquely amongst them all actually was an actual historical person on Earth. And so where would you go to look for that evidence? And you would go, let's look at the earliest documents you can find. And decades before the Gospels get written, placing Jesus in Earth history, you have the letters of Paul. And you know, mainstream scholars agree there's only 7 of those letters that are authentic. So we're narrowed down to like these 7 authentic letters of Paul. They're written in the 50s AD, so about 20 years after the event would have occurred if it were a historical earthly event, when the religion began. So when we look at those now, when we look at the authentic letters of Paul, he repeatedly says the teachings of Jesus came by revelation after his death. I mean, he never mentions anyone ever having met Jesus or even seeing Jesus before his death. Paul never mentions Jesus selecting disciples or having a ministry or performing miracles or exorcisms or ever being or doing anything on earth. He's very vague about that. So just as Paul believes Satan, for example, was a historical person who fought a war in heaven and was cast down, yet still not becoming a person on earth, and we don't believe Satan is a real historical person who lived on earth. So also Paul may have believed the sacrificial drama played out by Jesus, which reversed the fall of Satan, it undid the effects of the fall of Satan, was similarly not on earth, right? So we know Paul and the early Jews and Christians of his day believed things like castles and gardens existed in the sky and the heavens, and that battles and burials took place there. So when we're reading the letters of Paul by themselves, we can't tell whether he means the crucifixion and burial of Jesus took place in the sky or on earth. He never says. He never says where Jesus was made or born or where he lived or where he died. He always references his death and resurrection as an event of cosmic significance. And so that's where we look at it looks a lot like Osiris cult in that regard. So from the letters of Paul, we just can't really tell which version of Jesus did he believe in, the modern idea of a historical Jesus who was embellished and legendized after his death, or this this parallel to Satan, a sort of anti-Satan, as it were, who undergoes a drama in the heavens. And that's the competing theory of the origins of Christianity that I'm advancing.
It's a very interesting theory, and in a sense hinges, I suppose, on a few things, so including that this was, as you say, a Jewish sort of version of these pagan sort of celestial savior cults that existed. Obviously, you're excluding a certain amount of the Pauline corpus by restricting it to the 7 right. that you believe are authentic. And obviously, presumably putting out there as well that the Gospels, which are obviously the accounts of Jesus' earthly life, were later fictions, essentially, kind of clothing in flesh and blood this what was originally really a celestial figure. So is that kind of a summary to some extent of the different elements that need to be in place for your thesis to carry?
Yes, of course. That's it begins there in just that brief summary. There's obviously a lot more to be said.
there's a lot more to be said.
That captures the gist of it.
Yeah. Well, let's start with general things then, Jonathan, as you respond to this. I guess maybe first of all, this idea that the Christian movement really was a Jewish version in the first instance of other celestial cults, the Osiris cult and others, but put in this kind of formulated in this particular way. What's your approach to that when you compare it to other cults of the time?
Yeah, as Carrier mentioned, we have to look at the epistles of Paul and the New Testament material to see whether it does correspond to that sort of model or paradigm that he is advocating for. I just wanted to note for the record that I don't subscribe to his minimal Pauline corpus that he wants to pin Paul down to just 7 of the 13 letters of his. Let me quote from Richard Carrier from his book On the Historicity of Jesus. He writes, and I quote, "There is a great deal wrong with how a consensus has been reached on the dates and authorship of all these Christian materials, and the conclusions usually cited as established tend to be far more questionable than most scholars let on. I think there is a lot of work here that needs to be properly redone in New Testament studies, and I'm not alone in thinking that." I completely agree with Dr. Carrier.
I actually agree with that as well.
Given you wrote it, that shouldn't surprise us, yes. But Carrier, what are you about to comment on it, Jonathan?
So I think that the reason I agree with it is probably the opposite reason from why Dr. Carrier agrees with it. Because I think that Paul wrote all 13 letters of Paul, and I think that a lot of the conclusions that are cited as established in New Testament scholarship, such as the authorship of the 13 letters of Paul, are based on rather shaky foundation. And in fact, I find the case for the Pauline authorship of the 13 letters of Paul more persuasive than the case against that. But that being said, let's look at the information that we can extract about the life of Jesus from the Pauline epistles. And I know Dr. Kira has written a lot on each of these, so we'll probably not get through all of them. But Paul says that he's born of the seed of David in Romans 1:3, that he's born of a woman born under the law in Galatians 4:4, that he stood before Pontius Pilate in 1 Timothy 2:13, and I take 1 Timothy to be written by Paul, teachings about divorce in 1 Corinthians 7 verse 10. He is betrayed in 1 Corinthians 11:23. We have the Last Supper in 1 Corinthians 11. Also, he had brothers, according to Galatians 1:19 and 1 Corinthians 9:5. He had 12 special followers in 1 Corinthians 15 verse 5. He was crucified by the rulers of this age in 1 Corinthians 2:8, and he was killed by the Jews in 1 Thessalonians 2, verses 13-16. So maybe we could take one of these at a time and kind of interact on those texts. I mean, we could start perhaps with the rulers of this age that we read of in 1 Corinthians 2 that are said to have crucified the Lord of glory. Let me just read the text and let Dr. Carrier spell out his position on it, and then we can interact from there. We read, and I quote, this is 1 Corinthians 2. But we impart a secret and hidden wisdom of God, which God decreed before the ages for our glory. None of the rulers of this age understood this, for if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. So, Dr. Carey, take it away.
Yes, archons of this aeon is the actual Greek under that, which is a phraseology that's really weird, that Paul does not refer to human rulers anywhere as archons of this aeon. He refers to them as archons. Archons is a generic word for rulers, but archons was also a term at the time for demonic powers. And even, you know, the Christian scholar Origen agreed that the archons of this aeon, Paul was referencing demons in this passage. So that's the thing, is it's vague. So what does he mean? Does he mean Romans? Does he mean Jews? Does he mean Satan and his demons? And we have a Christian text from around the same time as the canonical Gospels called the Ascension of Isaiah, which actually in its earliest redaction that we can reconstruct appears to have Satan and his demonic followers in the sky doing the crucifying of Jesus. So it's vague. So when we look at Paul, we don't know what he's referring to. Does he mean by archons of this aeon, you know, the demonic forces of the world, or historical forces of some kind? Does he mean Jews? Does he mean Romans? And one thing that's weird about that passage is it says that if they'd known killing Jesus would save everyone, they would have stopped the crucifixion. In other words, they would have wanted to thwart God's plan to save everyone's life and give everyone eternal life, which is a plan that makes no sense for the Jews or the Romans. And it does make sense for Satan and his demons, who want to keep death in the world. So it's this cosmic drama that Paul seems to be referring to, not a historical event. And we also have Romans 13, where Paul says that the people who are in power are always there doing God's will, that they're in place by, you know, God's will and do God's will, and therefore you should obey the authorities. Paul never has an apologetic in that section in Romans 13 to explain it. Well, except for the rulers who killed Jesus, obviously they were trying to thwart God's plan. And so God had to hide the truth, the cosmic truth of the death, so that they wouldn't, and so on. There's an incongruity here in Paul's theology. It doesn't make sense. It's almost as if Paul doesn't know that when he says the archons of this aeon crucified Jesus, that he was basically impugning the Roman and Jewish authorities that in Romans 13 he's actually trying to support.
Just before we come to Jonathan responding to that, I mean, in some sense, it's strange to me at all that Paul would put a crucifixion in a sort of celestial in the sky, is what you're saying, that he had in mind, some sort of other sphere, because crucifixion obviously was a very earthly form of execution. So
Hebrews 9, I think, says that everything that on earth has copies in heaven. There are versions in heaven, and we have this in the Ascension of Isaiah as well, that for every level of heaven, including the upper firmament where Satan and his demons reigned, there were versions of everything. So there's versions of gardens and castles and graveyards and things in every different level of heaven. This is a standard Jewish cosmological view at the time. So when you're talking about a crucifixion, of course they're going to use the version of crucifixion that is a copy of what's going on earth, right? So if Satan is going to kill Jesus, that's going to be a crucifixion. That's the way they're going to mock this person,
okay,
and destroy him. So it makes sense in context of the way people at that time understood the cosmology of the world.
it still sounds obviously very strange, you know,
to our ears.
The idea of Jesus sort of being crucified in outer space or something. But okay, where do you want to pick up your criticisms on this, Jonathan?
Sure. So let's deal with this text that we were dealing with in 1 Corinthians 2. As Dr. Carrier notes, the word archon, he argues, could refer to human authorities and rulers, or it could refer to demonic or spiritual forces. In Romans 13, which he mentioned, it's clearly, I think, talking about human rulers and authorities. It says in Romans 13, and I quote, "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not terror," it's archontes, the plural of archon there again, "are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad." And so there, in that context, that word is talking about human authorities. Now, so the question that we want to address is it talking about human authorities in 1 Corinthians 2, or is it talking about spiritual or demonic forces? So let's take a look at the surrounding context in 1 Corinthians chapter 2. In the previous chapter, in chapter 1, verse 20, it says, "Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world?" He refers to human wisdom, human strength, a human perspective, and things that are foolish, weak, insignificant, despised in the world. And he says that his speech was, quote, "not based on the wisdom of men, and it was not a wisdom of this age or of the rulers of this age." And it's in this context that we get to verse 8 of 1 Corinthians 2. "None of the rulers or contes of this age, eon, understood this. For if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory." And then verse 9, the next verse says, "What no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the heart of man imagined, what God has prepared for those who love him." And in verse 11, "For who knows a person's thoughts except the spirit of that person which is in him? So also no one comprehends the thoughts of God except the Spirit of God." And in case we still weren't convinced, here are verses 12 through 16. We read, "Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, that we might understand the things freely given us by God. And we impart this in words not taught by human wisdom, but taught by the Spirit, interpreting spiritual truths to those who are spiritual. The natural person does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are folly to him, and he is not able to understand them because they are spiritually discerned. The spiritual person judges all things, but is himself to be judged by no one. For who has understood the mind of the Lord so as to instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ." And so this to me seems to be inescapable, that the rulers being spoken of here are indeed human rulers and not demonic or spiritual forces. I'm not at all persuaded by this interpretation. Also, regarding the word eon of this age in 1 Corinthians 2:8, can that word be used in a plain and temporal sense? Well, absolutely, because Paul uses the same word in 1 Corinthians 1, verse 20. "Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age?" Again, using the Greek word eon at that point. And also in the next chapter in 1 Corinthians 3:18, "Let no one deceive himself. If anyone among you thinks that he is wise in this age or eon, let him become a fool that he may become wise."
So we're going to go to a quick break, and I'll let Richard, you come back on this. But if you're just joining us on the program today, we're quoting a lot of scripture, and that's because we're trying to get to the bottom of whether Richard Carrier's thesis that Paul believed Jesus was actually a celestial being who experienced a sort of otherworldly celestial crucifixion and resurrection and everything else, whether that was really what he believed. He didn't actually believe in a flesh and blood historical Jesus. And we've got Jonathan McClatchy here in the studio putting the opposite case, saying, just starting really with this section in 1 Corinthians 2, saying, as far as you can see, that it's inescapable that the crucifixion Jesus is referring to by the rulers of this age are not some demonic realm. It's he's talking about the authorities in Palestine in that era, you know, and so on. So we'll hear what Richard Carrier has to say in response, and we'll widen this out to the book of Acts as well. I think there's a really interesting discussion to be had as well on that in the next section of today's program. You're listening to Unbelievable, the place where we bring you the strongest objections to Christianity and try to meet them with the best evidences for Christianity in return. We'll be back in a moment's time.
Who are we?
Where do we come from?
How did the universe evolve?
Questions like these matter, and we're all asking them. That's why Reasons to Believe, a global Christian organization, is dedicated to helping those on a journey. Our mission is to show skeptics and believers alike how we believe that sound reasoning and scientific advancement strengthens rather than erodes our confidence in the scriptures and in the personal God that they reveal. Be challenged as you search and test what is true. For more information, visit reasons.org. Reasons to Believe, where science and faith converge.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's programme. Today on the show, we're talking about the mythicist view of Jesus. Now, this has been a growing movement, online especially, and perhaps one of the most significant people in the movement is Richard Carrier. And he says, OK, there's lots of crazy, sort of very ill-thought-through, non-academic versions of Jesus' mythicism. People who say, I don't know, that it was just something invented by the Roman authorities to quell the Jews, the Christ thing. Richard says, fair enough, let's put those to one side. But here's a credible theory. The very earliest witness we have to Jesus Christ in the letters of Paul, actually, as far as Richard is concerned, never believed in a historical flesh and blood Jesus. That was not the basis of his belief. It was a sort of celestial savior cult was what Paul was promoting and what he had received, really, from the other initiators of the Christian movement. And that only later in the Gospels and elsewhere was sort of flesh and blood put onto this Jesus character. So he's one of my guests on Unbelievable today, and in the sort of going supporting, if you like, the mainstream view is Jonathan McClatchy, which is kind of ironic, actually, Jonathan, because on last week's show you were representing the minority view of intelligent design against the evolutionary view. Today you're the boots on the other foot, as it were, and Richard Carrier is presenting the minority view. You're presenting the majority view. Where do you want to go, though, next, Richard? I don't want to spend too long debating this particular passage, but I'm sure you'll want to respond to what Jonathan had to say.
Well, yeah, we'll want to move on to Acts eventually. Yeah, I think in everything that McClatchy said, it's 50-50, right? So archons of this aeon, just the vocabulary, if you're just going to decide on the vocabulary, you can't tell. It can mean both. It can mean either earthly rulers, or it can mean celestial demonic forces. And I think you either stop there, it's either 50-50, it's indeterminate, we can't tell from that passage, or you can go further and point out the thing that I showed, that was this contradiction between what Paul is saying regarding the motives and knowledge, that's the weird cosmic spiritual knowledge of these archons of the aeon, with Romans 13, what Paul says about the rulers that are appointed by God and wouldn't try to thwart God's will. So if you look at things like that, the context really does start to look a lot like the alternative view. And I think, you know, at best it's 50-50, and I think it slightly skews in favor of the mythicist thesis on that.
What do you make of that particular comeback that Paul seems to be at odds with elsewhere, where he says this was always God's plan that the rulers were doing, and saying, but if they hadn't, you know, and there's no reason the Romans or the Jews would have thwarted God's salvation plan. But obviously, the demonic realm would have had every reason to, and if they had known, they wouldn't have crucified the Lord of Glory and so on.
Yeah, I mean, I think I gave the context quite well, both before that verse in 1 Corinthians 2 and after, to show that the consistent argument or thread of what Paul's saying concerns humans. And so I think that the archon or the archontes spoken of there in 1 Corinthians 2 are human rulers and authorities. He mentioned Romans 13. Where it speaks about rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. I think Paul is instructing us to submit ourselves to the governing authorities and rulers here on earth, even if they are bad. I mean, Jesus says, "Render to Caesar what is Caesar's." Right.
I mean, it also strikes me that even if you are someone who does take the mainstream view that Jesus was crucified by the Roman authorities with the support of the Jewish authorities or whatever, that Paul still obviously does believe that there's a spiritual element going on, that at some level the demonic realm is cheering this on, is in favour of this, wants this to happen. So it's not as though we're excluding demonic language as well. In that sense, Jonathan?
Yeah, absolutely. Archon can refer to human rulers, or it could refer to demonic forces. But the question is, I mean, the meaning of Greek words is shaved down by the context. And I think the context here in 1 Corinthians 2 clearly indicates it's human rulers being spoken of.
I'm aware we're not going to solve this one now. And there's probably lots of other intricate passages we could look at. One that I'll just bring in quickly, because it's often the one that's, I think, been put out there by people like Bart Ehrman to you, and others, Richard, is just throwaway references. I think someone else tell me, but when he talks about James, the brother of Jesus, Ehrman and others say, look, there's no motivation here. There's no sort of, they're not trying to theologize anything. It's just a throwaway reference to James, the brother of Jesus. You don't get a brother of Jesus without a Jesus to, for him to be the sibling of. So what's your explanation of those kinds of, you know, moments in Paul's letters, Richard?
Yeah, for anyone who wants to go deep dive on this, of course, my book on the historicity of Jesus really has sections on all of this stuff with scholarship cited and all of that. But to just quickly answer that one, we know for a fact that Paul believed that all baptized Christians were brothers of the Lord. Jesus is the firstborn of many brethren. So when he's talking about brothers of the Lord, does he mean just non-apostolic Christian? Is that just the word for Christian that he uses at the time? Does he mean cultic brother or does he mean biological brother? And once again, it's unclear. The way he talks about it, he only uses the term twice in his letters, that the letters that we have. So we don't really know. It's once again, it's 50-50. It's vague, which is kind of strange. I think it would be more clear if he's going to talk about the family of Jesus. You'd think there'd be more explicit references to biological kin rather than him making the distinction between, oh, yes, there are brothers of the Lord who are cultic brothers, and then there are biological brothers. You would think you would need to make that distinction.
Do you? I mean, I'm not familiar with the precise Greek and the language used here, but would it have been possible for Paul to make it a lot clearer that he was talking about a biological sibling rather than a more general spiritual brotherhood?
Yes, he could say brother of the Lord in the flesh, for example, or something like that. There's a variety of ways he could do it, and he would feel the need to do it if, given the fact that we know that he knows and his readers know that brothers of the Lord are also baptized Christians. So he would need to make some sort of distinction and say, well, I mean a particular kind of brother of the Lord.
And what's your view on why he singled out James for this title at this particular moment in these particular letters?
Well, he had to. I reference Trudinger, the scholarship of Trudinger in my book, where he points out that the grammar here actually says, I met the only apostle I met was Peter, and then I met this other guy, James. In other words, the grammar is actually saying that this James is not an apostle, that he's someone else. And in this argument, in the context of the argument, Paul has to basically mention every Christian he met, because he's trying to say that he spoke to hardly anyone. He only got all his information about Christianity by revelation, which we can argue may be dishonest. But nonetheless, that's what he has to insist to the Galatians, is that he only got his information by revelation. He was evangelizing for years before he met any of the apostles to get information from them. And he says, you know, even after 3 years, I went to Jerusalem and I only met this apostle, Peter, and this other guy, James. And so he has to name all of the particular Christians he met. Otherwise, his accusers would say, oh, no, but, you know, he talked to this other Christian at that time. So he's basically just making a distinction between apostolic and non-apostolic Christians and saying he only met two Christians on that visit. And then it was many, many years later before he met them.
And so he uses the word brother to distinguish James from being an apostolic Christian. But as far as you're concerned, that could easily just be the brother in the sort of spiritual sense.
It's the same sense as saying I met the Pope and this other Christian, James, for example. I mean, you know, it's that kind of thing. He doesn't want to say I just met some random guy, James. He doesn't want to confuse people into saying that I met the actual biological brother of Peter. So he has to actually say brother of the Lord, James, to specify what he means.
Well, Jonathan, even today, you know, Christians call each other brother and sister in the Lord. That's sort of, you know, common terminology. Why in this instance do you feel, no, Paul is actually referring to the biological sense of brother when he talks to James?
I mean, this is actually something which is debated by Greek scholars as to whether Paul is calling James in Galatians 1 an apostle or not. I think probably the majority of scholars think he is calling James an apostle, but be that as it may, if Richard Carrier was only relying on Galatians 1, I think he would have a plausible argument here. But and as Richard Carrier points out, we have Romans 8:29, where Jesus is described as being the firstborn among many brethren. However, we also have 1 Corinthians 9, where Paul mentions that that Cephas has taken himself a wife, as have the brothers of the Lord. I don't think he's speaking there just about general Christians taking for themselves wives. And also in Matthew's gospel, I think it's in chapter 13 and chapter 26, we have references to Jesus' brothers, one of whom mentioned is James. And then also in the book of Acts in chapter 1, Jesus' mother is praying alongside the brothers, and the fact that they're mentioned alongside the mother suggests that they are biological brothers at that point. And I would argue that Luke was a traveling companion of Paul, and so it's directly relevant to that.
Do you want to come back on that before we start talking about Acts, Richard?
Well, I think I actually discuss 1 Corinthians 9. Once again, he's making a distinction between apostolic and non-apostolic Christians. His argument there is that if even non-apostolic Christians are being given this benefit, because they're arguing over whether he deserves to receive free meals and stuff, if even non-apostolic Christians on church business are getting this, then so should he, because he's an apostle of all things. So it's once again, it's vague. Does he mean just baptized Christians, or does he mean biological brothers of Jesus? It's unclear. And then when you get to the other stuff, when you talk about, you know, what's in the Gospels and stuff, if we look at later legends, yes, of course, all kinds of later legends arose about the family of Jesus. That doesn't help us understand what Paul thought, because Paul doesn't show any awareness of these Gospel stories.
Do you think Paul doesn't show awareness of the Gospel stories, John?
Well, I think that it's rather a striking coincidence that Paul mentions a brother of the Lord called James, and then Matthew's Gospel mentions a brother of the Lord also called James. And most people interpret
Why would that be unusual when they're actually cribbing from Paul's letters to actually construct a family for Jesus?
Because clearly that's the way they understood it from Paul's letters. And it's also striking, incidentally, that...
Well, yeah, that's mm-hmm. the way the gospel legend writers are creating the legend. Yeah, for sure.
Well, obviously, your view is that they are creating a legend. Obviously,
that they picked the name James.
Right. So I happen to disagree with you, because I think that the Gospels actually go back to apostolic testimony. And so this is a point at which we're going to
differ.
Yes, of course.
I mean, it goes without saying that you have very different views on a whole range of biblical literature as to when it was produced, by whom, for what purposes, and so on. So obviously, Jonathan believes that the Gospels are... based on eyewitness testimony, for instance, that they were written much earlier, I imagine, than you think they were written, Richard, and so on. But I don't want to get too much into the Gospels. We have done the Gospels in other programs, but we rarely talk about the Book of Acts, which is an interesting one. Just briefly again, if you would, Richard, give us your summary of what you think the Book of Acts is, which, as far as I'm aware, you believe is basically a fictional account, by and large. Do you want to just sort of spell out what you think it is, and then we'll see what Jonathan has to say?
Yeah, Luke, the author of the Gospel, whoever he actually was, also wrote this sequel, which is the history of the church, beginning right after his Gospel ends, up for about 30 years. He gives like the early history of the church for one generation. And he has a mission there. He wants to basically propagandize the faith. He has a lot of particular agenda items. He wants to portray the Romans as always favorable to the Christians. He wants to portray the Christians as always law-abiding. He wants to portray the two factions of Christianity, the Torah observant and the Gentile sides of the church, as always getting along, and that they should get along. And there's a lot of other mission objectives he has in there. And he's doing it in the way that a lot of fictional history got written at the time. He's crafting stories to convey moral points, political points, and points about the gospel. If he's relying on historical sources at all, it's really difficult to figure out what are the historical facts and what are the embellishments and changes that he's making to it.
And to that extent, do you literally believe the whole thing is sort of cooked up from scratch? Or is there was there a early church community that he was at least drawing something from, or albeit in your view embellishing it greatly, or do you literally think this was him just sitting down and writing a story from his imagination?
I don't know. I suspect he had sources. I suspect there's some skeleton of truth in the structure here, and I find that I talk about this in chapter 9 of On the History of the City of Jesus, where I think there's peculiar things in Acts that suggest he's working from source material that he's layering on and adding to and changing
up. It strikes me that
it's just difficult to determine which is which.
I mean, all I can say is, if it was purely from his imagination, he's an extraordinary storyteller, because there's a great deal of detail in there, you know, almost too much detail sometimes, and as he elaborates on Paul's journeys and where he went and this happened and that happened and the other. But just coming back to you here, Jonathan, firstly, let's hear your response to that, why you think Acts is an actual telling of the history of what happened, and who you think Luke was in that respect, but also obviously how it ties back into our main subject here, whether the historical Jesus really was a flesh and blood person.
Right, great way to go. So I think that there's powerful evidence for the substantial veracity of Acts, and indeed that the author of Acts, who I take to be Luke, was a traveling companion of the Apostle Paul. I know Richard Carrier thinks that the Book of Acts is largely historical fiction, that it was written even in the second century, and I don't find those positions at all plausible or tractable. Let's take an example of how it relates to the letters of Paul. So William Paley, who's one of my great heroes of Christian history, in his book Horae Paulinae, lays out an argument that he calls undesigned coincidences. And I know Richard Carrier has written a couple times on this issue. In the Book of Acts, we find undesigned dovetailings with the Pauline epistles. Let me give an example to illustrate. In 1 Corinthians 4, for example, Paul mentions in verse 17, "That's why I sent you Timothy, my beloved and faithful child in the Lord, to remind you of my ways in Christ, as I teach them everywhere in every church." So at the time that Paul is writing to the Corinthian Christians, he's already sent Timothy to the Corinthian Christians. In chapter 16, though, we read in verse 10, "When Timothy comes, see that you put him at ease among you, for he is doing the work of the Lord as I am." So although he's already sent Timothy at the time of his writing, he nonetheless expects his letter to arrive in Corinth before Timothy gets there. Now, where is he writing from? We know he's writing from Ephesus because he mentions Aquila and Priscilla sending their greetings from Ephesus. And so if we look at the Book of Acts, we should predict that presumably he sent his letter by boat over the Aegean Sea from Ephesus to Corinth and sent Timothy up the indirect overland route to Corinth from Ephesus. Now, when we read it in the Book of Acts in chapter 18, chapter 19, when he's in Ephesus, we read in verse 21, "Now after these events, Paul resolved in the spirit to pass through Macedonia and Achaia," that's where Corinth is in Greece, "and go to Jerusalem, saying, after I have been there, I must also see Rome. And having sent into Macedonia two of his helpers, Timothy and Erastus, he himself stayed in Asia for a while." And so we have these texts from 1 Corinthians 4, 1 Corinthians 16, and Acts 19, which fit together like a jigsaw and thus corroborate one another and substantiate the veracity of the Book of Acts.
Okay. It's worth, if you're listening on podcast, just listening back to that, because there's a lot to take in there. But essentially, it's almost like a detective sort of putting together this happened here, this happened here, oh, and this happened here, and they all corroborate each other
right
in ways that couldn't possibly have been planned sort of in some sense. So, okay, it's an interesting way of trying to show that the Book of Acts is historically valid, because if we're happy that this letter, the First Corinthians, was written by Paul about things that happened when he sent Timothy and so on, then it seems to align perfectly with the story that Luke tells in Acts of when he sent Timothy and all that kind of thing. What's your take on that way of trying to corroborate the Book of Acts, Richard?
Well, it doesn't help us figure out which things Luke has added or changed, right? So just the fact that he's using the letters of Paul as source material, he may have had some other source material, that doesn't help us determine which things are actually coming from authentic sources and which things are embellishments or changes or alterations. And we know for a fact that Luke is wantonly altering things. He definitely has the letters of Paul as source material, but he is wantonly contradicting them. And I'll give you examples. Paul himself tells us that he was unknown by face to anyone in Judea until years after his conversion. Acts has him already a famous person living in Judea from the beginning. Paul says he went to Arabia for years immediately after his conversion. Acts completely erases his mission to Arabia and has him immediately go to Damascus and then back to Judea. And then Paul says he was the one sent by Jesus to the Gentiles, and that he had to persuade Peter to accept his Torah-free gospel, and it took years to convince him. Acts has Peter instead receive the revelation from Jesus that preaches the Torah-free gospel, and Peter and Paul are on the same page about that before they even meet. And so there are many other aspects of direct contradiction between what Acts says of Paul and what Paul himself tells us, which really tells us we can't trust Acts, because Acts, whoever's writing it, is trying to write their own story. They're changing things that they don't like. They're getting rid of things they don't like. They're altering the chronology. And we have other examples of mistakes that are made. For example, Acts incorrectly asserts that the messianic pretender Theudas appeared before the census of 6 AD, when in fact his events, Theudas and his whole story, took place in the 40s AD, quite famously, which would have been directly contemporary with Paul, and thus Luke, if Luke was a companion of Paul. So a companion of Paul could not have made that mistake about Theudas, whereas we can explain this mistake if he was using source material not related to Christianity, if he was using the Antiquities of the Jews by Josephus, for example.
Well, there's quite a few things to...
So when you look at all that stuff, that okay, means that we have a problem. We have Acts okay is clearly not telling the truth a lot. And so even if you find examples of, oh, maybe it's got this part right, that doesn't help us with the other stuff.
Okay, there was a lot of, I won't try and repeat it all, but a number of different areas where obviously Richard feels there's a direct contradiction with the letters of Paul, and if that's showing anything, it's that whoever wrote down Acts, they were kind of rejigging things and remolding things to suit their own agendas and so on. General response or particular responses to any of those issues?
For example, he mentioned Galatians 1 and Paul swearing that he didn't go up to Jerusalem, but rather he went away to Arabia, and Acts doesn't mention this in Acts chapter 9. In Acts chapter 9, we read in verse 23, when many days had passed, the Jews plotted to kill him, but their plot became known to Saul. They were watching the gates day and night in order to kill him, etc. And he goes to Jerusalem. So the key point here is, what does it mean for Luke to write many days? And if you look, I think it's in 1 Kings chapter 2, the same term, many days, is taken to refer to a three-year span at that point. So it doesn't necessarily, I mean, I think Luke here in Acts chapter 1 is telescoping quite significantly. And also on the point that he made about the undesigned coincidence that I mentioned in 1 Corinthians 4:16 and Acts 19, I don't think it helps his case at all to propose that Luke is using Paul's epistles as source material, because these are things which are undesigned. It's where you have a natural question that's raised by one source, and in fact two different passages put together in 1 Corinthians, and then it's resolved in Acts in an undesigned way. And there's plenty of those that, and as a cumulative case, it becomes, I think, rather preposterous to insist that they're all just coincidental. There are also instances of external corroboration in Acts. For example, in Acts chapter 23, verses 4 and 5, it says that Paul is before Ananias, the high priest. Those who stood by said, "Would you revile God's high priest?" And Paul said, "I did not know, brothers, that he was a high priest." And it turns out that Ananias, of whom this is spoken, was in truth not the high priest, but he was sitting in judgment in that assumed capacity. In fact, the case was that he had formally held the office, but he'd been deposed, and the person who succeeded him had been murdered, and there wasn't yet another occupying the station. And so in the vacancy, he had of his own authority taken upon himself the discharge of that office. There's the fact that he mentions that during the riot in Ephesus in Acts 19, he reports the city clerk tells the crowd that there are proconsuls, so in the plural. And the proconsul, of course, is a Roman authority to whom a complaint might be taken. And normally there'd only be one proconsul, but just at that particular time, we know from Tacitus that there seems to have been two proconsuls as a result of the assassination of Silenus, who was a previous proconsul, by poisoning in the fall of 54 by the two imperial stewards at the urging of Nero's mother. So you have these external corroborations which then support the Book of Acts. And these are things which we have to be careful not to commit the Wikipedia fallacy or the Google fallacy and assume that all the people back then in the ancient world had access to Wikipedia and Google and the sort of resources that we have access to today. Now, these are hard things to get right if you're not an eyewitness.
So you're saying the fact that various things that would have been very difficult for someone making up, doing a fictional history, to have anticipated or written in, are explained by these corroborating factors, either in the letters of Paul or in other sources, which make sense of things that it's very hard to understand why they would be there, if for any other reason. I mean, you're still highly skeptical, I assume, Richard, of this way of corroborating the account of Acts.
Yeah, we won't have time to go into every detail there. I think there's a lot of dubious stuff that was just said. But the fact of the matter, I mean, if we could just boil it down to, Luke is definitely using source material. That doesn't tell us that just because he's using source material for some of these incidental details to build out his stories, that doesn't tell us that the rest of the stuff is true. And we've got many examples where it's clearly not. Now, let's focus on just one thing that McClatchy just mentioned, which is you said something about the passage where the Jews are trying to kill Paul. It was the first point you made about how somehow the years in Arabia are in Acts. Can you tell me what verse you were relying on?
In Acts or Galatians?
The Book of Acts.
In the Book of Acts, this is in chapter number 9. Sorry, let me find
just
it.
Just looking it up.
Yeah, yeah. this is...
Well, I thought you read it. Didn't you read
the verse? No, I closed my Bible. It's verse 23.
Verse 23.
Verse 23, which reads...
Do you want to just read it out for us again?
When many days had passed, the Jews plotted to kill him, but their plot became known to Saul. They were watching the gates day and night in order to kill him. But his disciples took him by night and led him down through an opening in the wall, luring in a basket. And when he had come to Jerusalem, he attempted to join the disciples, etc.
Yeah, that's in Damascus, though. So where when was he in Arabia?
Right, it doesn't say, but I think Luke is telescoping here. I don't think he has to throw in every single detail that happened. But I don't
well,
think,
if he parks Paul in Damascus and then gets to a few verses later him escaping from Damascus, that's kind of obvious where Luke wants us to imagine Paul was.
Right, but he says when he had come to...
I mean, it's weird to like insert a three-year sojourn to Arabia in that period where somehow they're trying to kill him immediately as soon as he converts, and yet somehow he's able to get away, do a whole mission in Arabia for 3 years, come back to Damascus, and then suddenly now he's trapped in Damascus and he has to escape from Damascus? That doesn't make a lot of sense.
Just explain how what you're meaning by this idea of the many days then.
Yeah, so I don't think Luke necessarily even perhaps knew about the trip to Arabia. Paul may or may not have told him, but... I don't think this contradicts the Book of Galatians. Paul may simply not have known this. He knew that there were plots made to kill him, and so he leaves Damascus, and then he's in Arabia. We know that from verse 26 when he comes to Jerusalem. So I don't think this necessarily contradicts the Galatians.
There's no reference to Arabia there, so I don't know.
No, I agree with you. I don't think there's a reference to Arabia, but I don't think it contradicts Galatians.
Let's move on, because just before we sort of have to go to a break, tying this back into the question of the historical Jesus, for you, Jonathan, the fact that you believe that there's evidence that Paul went on all these journeys, had these interactions with people like Luke, presumably that's relevant, because then that corroborates the gospel account of Luke. Just explain how in your view this all helps to take us back to the historical Jesus, the fact that you do believe that Acts is a historical account of Paul's comings and goings.
So if the book of Acts is indeed written by a traveling companion of Paul, then it seems to strain credulity that he would have ended up with this very historical Jesus in the speeches in Acts, and also indeed in the Gospel of Luke, which I take to be written by the same person. If indeed Paul had this idea of a celestial Jesus. And indeed, I think that Paul himself has access to Luke's gospel because he quotes it in 1 Timothy 5:18, which, of course, Kiri is going to deny.
So I'm putting the pieces together here. So basically, if Paul was a traveling companion of Luke, it seems we wouldn't have had all this historical Jesus stuff in Acts. We would have had the celestial Jesus stuff, in a sense, if that's who Luke was traveling with and getting his theology from. But as it is now, obviously, Richard's point is he just doesn't believe Luke was a traveling companion with Paul. He thinks he was taking him as sources and inventing a story. So that's obviously where you part company majorly. But it's helped me to see how this engages with the whole question of what Paul believed. We're going to go to a quick break, and I'm sure Richard will have some more to bring to us, and Jonathan as well, as we continue to discuss the question: did the Apostle Paul believe in a real or a celestial Jesus? That's our question on Unbelievable Today. Final part of the show coming up shortly.
Alexandra, does God exist?
I'm sorry, I cannot answer this question.
Well, what is the point of life then?
Please, ask this question to someone qualified, ideally human.
Truth is, artificial intelligence and search engines can't really help with some questions, which is why I'd love you to join me, Justin Brierley, at Unbelievable The Conference 2018. Honest answers from an international team of thinkers, including our partners Reasons to Believe, equipping you to share your Christian faith in our skeptical world. Unbelievable The Conference 2018. Your questions answered. London, the 19th of May. Early bird discounts available at premier.org.uk/justask.
Welcome back to the Unbelievable Radio Show and podcast with me, Justin Brierley. And coming up next week, if you're able to come back for Unbelievable, we'll be talking about how does petitionary prayer work. I'm going to be joined by Mark Karras, author of a new book called Divine Echoes, Reconciling Prayer with the Uncontrolling Love of God. He says we need to radically rethink prayer, how we do it, how it works. Steve Jeffrey will be presenting a more traditional Calvinist view of prayer on that program at the same time next week. And if you can stay tuned to Premier Christian Radio on the profile straight after Unbelievable between 4 and 5, youth evangelist and musician Chip Kendall will be speaking to Sam Hales. The profile available on its own podcast, of course. And if you download it, you can get last week's program, which was my special tribute to Billy Graham, his life and legacy, talking to friends, family and ministry colleagues in the wake of his death at the age of 99. That programme was slightly cut short on the podcast when it first was uploaded. Now they're available in full in case you didn't catch the whole programme. Just look for The Profile wherever you get your podcasts from. Before we get back into today's discussion, I want to make you aware that the Unbelievable Discussion Group, which meets regularly in London, is set to meet again on Monday the 12th of March. This time, Andrew White, an agnostic, will be talking on when should we expect the end of the age, and that all ties into Andrew's own journey from Christian faith to agnosticism. And we're looking at, did Jesus say the end of the age would come in the lifetime of his followers? And the AD 70 events were his referent. Was Jesus teaching on two sets of events? Those kinds of questions will be unpacked by Andrew, and there'll be a discussion as usual between the Christians and skeptics who meet there. So that's on Monday the 12th of March, the Unbelievable Discussion Group, 7:30 p.m. at Somerstown Coffee House Pub near King's Cross. More details available as usual at the meetup.com website. You're looking for the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group in London. Now, I had a lovely email from Fred, who I actually met in a coffee shop about a year and a bit ago when I was actually working on my book, Unbelievable, the Book Why, after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. We got chatting about C.S. Lewis, our shared love of C.S. Lewis. And you were going to send me, Fred, the details of a recent radio program on that, which you do in this email because you finally got around and found a way of contacting me and said that you've since started to download the show via Podbean, and you've consumed around 30 episodes of the show, which you've enjoyed a great deal. And you've also bought the book, and we'll start it this week, having just finished my fourth C.S. Lewis biography. Crumbs, Fred, you are a real fan, I can tell. Well, you'll also read a little bit about my own journey with C.S. Lewis in the book. So I hope you enjoy that, Fred. And it's been great to connect with you again on email after we met briefly in that coffee shop where I spent most of the time working on the book that finally came into existence. Glad you've got it in your hands. If you want to get hold of signed copies of the book, of course, that's still available from the book website, unbelievablebook.co.uk. Ship them out to anywhere in the world if you'd like a signed copy. And I'm so pleased that I'm going to be out in Canada at the Apologetics Canada conference this weekend, the 2nd and 3rd of March. And Mike Klein emails to say that he and his wife will be attending and looking forward to buying a copy of the book and getting it signed. Also, Andy Bannister to get a copy of his book, The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, and sign it there. You say, I'm hoping there'll be a meet and greet time. I've been listening to the podcast for years now, and I'm sad that I've burned through the back archive and now only get to listen to Unbelievable once a week. Well, I certainly do hope we get to meet up, Mike. Great to hear from you. And as well as speaking in Canada this weekend at the Apologetics Canada conference, I was also privileged to deliver the Bishop of Sheffield's annual lecture earlier in the week in Sheffield Cathedral, and met many of the clergy from the local diocese and also some people on the evening before. So it was great to be able to share the details of the show, My Case for God, and the book, of course, there too. If you'd like to get hold of it yourself, again, unbelievablebook.co.uk. We'll be hearing some more of your feedback towards the end of today's programme. For the moment, let's get into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
It's been a really interesting discussion today. Richard Carrier has been on the show, making the claim, this is the central part of his thesis, really, that Jesus Christ, when it comes to the very origins of Christianity, was never envisioned as a flesh and blood historical person. He was a sort of celestial saviour. And that's the kind of Jesus that Paul believed in, that the very first apostles believed in. It was only later that he got sort of dressed up in historical sort of situations in the Gospels. We've had coming against that today on the programme, Jonathan McClatchy, saying, no, there's lots of reasons to believe that Paul was fully invested in a historical view of Jesus Christ. Not only from his letters, but also from the book of Acts. We've done some debate on that and why Richard believes it was historical fiction and Jonathan doesn't. The place we haven't gone yet, and which is the place most people go for looking at the historical Jesus is, of course, the gospel. So maybe that's a good place to try and tackle just in the last few minutes of today's program. I think you wanted to come back, though, Richard, with something before we get into that. Did you want to go ahead?
Yeah, and it does relate to the Gospels issue. So, McClatchy's position is that Luke was a traveling companion of Paul, and therefore Luke Acts, meaning the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts, were written by someone who knew Paul. And that's almost, not quite, but almost the same as arguing that Paul wrote Luke and Acts, right? So if you imagine, let's say, for example, that actually was the case, that Paul had written the Gospel, what we call the Gospel of Luke, and had written the Book of Acts, that would be really strong evidence for historicity. I don't think mysticism would have a balance of probability were that the case. So I can see the logic of the argument there is sound. I just don't see, we just can't establish that Luke was a traveling companion of Paul. He never even outright says he was, for example. So that's debatable. And so that it does come down to, when are we going to place the Gospels as to when they were written? What can we actually establish versus conjecture regarding who wrote them and what sources they used?
Just remaining with Acts for a moment, because this has just occurred to me, and I'm no way as engaged in these texts as you both are. But one thing that is obvious to anyone reading the Gospels is that reading Acts is that at some point there, suddenly the narrator goes from a sort of third person history of what's happening to a first person one. So, and this is at some point in the missionary journeys of Paul, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And suddenly he's starting to talk about, we went to Patmos and we got shipwrecked and this happened to me and Paul. Does that at any level, I'll start with you, Jonathan, sort of confirm for you that this is that Luke is the traveling companion, because he kind of switches to this first person mode at a particular point when it appears he was traveling alongside Paul in this
mode? From Acts 16 onwards, there's the famous we sayings of the Book of Acts, and I don't. There are different interpretations of the we passages. Some see it as a literary device for one or another purpose. I think that when you combine it with the external corroborations and the undesigned coincidences, then taken together, it supports Luke as being a traveling companion of Paul. And indeed, Paul himself tells us that Luke was a traveling companion of Paul in the book of Colossians in chapter 4.
I guess, and I'm sure you can shoot this down very easily, Richard, but in my untutored mind, I'm thinking, okay.
Well, I mean, Colossians doesn't say that Luke wrote the book of Acts, so we can't connect those two. The other side of it is that even if the author were intending us to understand that he was with Paul at the time, that doesn't mean the author is telling the truth. We already know the author doesn't tell the truth a lot. But the use of first person plural for sea adventures, and the we passages are all tie into to sea travels, was a known device in fiction. So that's, and you can find this in the mainstream scholarship. I mean, there's a lot of discussion of this, that the we passages aren't really determinative as to whether the author really was a companion of Paul or even wanted you to understand that he was.
Well, look, we'll leave that one to one side. Let's talk about the Gospels specifically. Maybe start with you, Jonathan. What for you are some of the things that Richard has to deal with when it comes to the Gospels that for you suggest they can't be seen as later sort of fabrications or made up stories that help to kind of put Jesus in a place and time and history and so on? What for you are the fingerprints, the clues that help us see this genuinely was a place, time, and history associated with Jesus?
Well, again, I would like to draw on the argument from undesigned coincidences that we find in the Gospels. So let me give just one or two examples very quickly. In John chapter 6, of course, we have the feeding of the 5,000 miracle, and Jesus turns to Philip in verse 5 to say, where should we send the people to buy bread? And it raises the question immediately in the audience's mind, why does he turn to Philip? Because Philip's a fairly minor character in the Gospels. Why not turn to, you know, Judas Iscariot, who's in charge of the money bag, or someone like that? Why Philip specifically? And we also read about Andrew getting involved in a reply to Jesus. Now, why does Andrew specifically get involved in the reply? These are extraneous details not found in any other Gospel. Now, if you go over to John chapter 12, we learn that Philip is from a certain town called Bethsaida. We also learn in John chapter 1 that that Andrew is from Bethsaida. It also mentions Philip being from Bethsaida there as well. In Luke's account of the feeding of the 5,000 miracle, in Luke chapter 9, he mentions that he doesn't mention Jesus turning to Philip, doesn't mention Andrew getting involved in the reply, but does mention that the event of the feeding of the 5,000 took place in Bethsaida, thus corroborating that these were the individuals to whom Jesus spoke in John chapter 6. Just one more example, if I may. In the Gospel of John in chapter 12, another extraneous detail not found in any other Gospel is the time at which Jesus approached Bethany. with the disciples. It says, 6 days before the Passover, Jesus therefore came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. And then they prepared dinner for him there in Bethany. And then the following day, he rides into Jerusalem, and you've got the triumphal entry scenario. In Mark's account of the same event, where Jesus approaches Bethany, he does not mention this happening 6 days before Passover. So if we and he doesn't mention that Jesus actually enters Jerusalem on the donkey 5 days before Passover, the day after. So if we assume then, if John is correct, that this actually happened 6 days before the Passover, and the triumphal entry happened 5 days before the Passover, we actually have a really neat undesigned coincidence. We find the end of the 5 days before the Passover in verse 11. He entered Jerusalem and went into the temple. When he looked around at everything, as it was already late, he went out to Bethany with the 12. That's the end of 5 days before Passover. Then on the following day, this is now 4 days before Passover, you've got the christening of the fig tree. And then verse 19, when evening came, they went out of the city. That's the end of 4 days before the Passover. And then you have it in verse 19, when evening came, they went out of the city. Then verse 20, as they passed by in the morning, they saw the fig tree withered away to its roots. So now we're 3 days before Passover. And then in chapter 13, you have the Olivet Discourse, which I think is happening in the evening, because the Mount of Olives, where this conversation takes place, is midway between the temple, where he's been all day, and Bethany, where he's staying. So that's the end then of 3 days before the Passover. And then in chapter 14, in verse 1, it says it was now 2 days before the Passover. So it calibrates and synchronizes perfectly at that point. So that is a pattern in both those cases, which I think is very difficult to explain on a mythicist paradigm.
Go ahead. All of the leading experts on John who've written, you know, entire treatises on the Gospel of John, they all agree now, and especially the most prominent ones in the past 20 plus years, that John is using the other Gospels as a source material. He's actually rewriting the Gospel in his own words, but he's using the other Gospels as his material. So he's actually, this is a designed coincidence. He's actually trying to clean up some things or make some things make sense or tell a story in a way that he thinks makes sense based on his source material. So that's not an undesigned coincidence. That's a designed coincidence insofar as it's a coincidence at all.
What makes you believe it's an undesigned coincidence? Just that it's unlikely that John would have spotted this particular, or the writer of John would have spotted this particular, you know, the way that these events transpired, and then inserted the very specific thing. Obviously, Richard feels, well, yeah, he spotted the same issue that you've spotted, just put you know, said, okay, this is the day it happened. What makes you believe that's not what's going on in this case?
So the case of the feeding of the 5,000 in John chapter 6, John does not mention that the event took place in Bethsaida. He doesn't even give that detail. In fact, he doesn't even mention that Philip or Andrew are from Bethsaida in John chapter 6. He mentions that in John chapter 12 and John chapter 1. And then the other puzzle pieces in Luke chapter 9, where the event took place in Bethsaida. So you would expect, if Richard Carrier's thesis is correct, that he would have mentioned the event took place in Bethsaida in John chapter 6.
I don't see why he would need to.
Right. Is he burying these hidden coincidences that weren't discovered until William Paley came along and documented them?
Why would he need to bury them? Like, it's not relevant to him, right? See, he's getting these ideas from the source material. It doesn't occur to him that he has to mention what city it was in. He's basing it on the source material that he has.
But Luke chapter 9 doesn't mention Jesus turning to Philip or Andrew getting involved in the replies. And so you've got...
John is like figuring, okay, so I'm going to have Jesus talk to some people. Who should I pick to be the people he talks to? He looks at his source material, he picks some people, and he does it. That's it. That's how it works. And we see exactly that kind of reasoning in all kinds of historical writing in the ancient world.
Mm-hmm. I guess I just don't buy that. You have one puzzle piece in Luke 9, and you have a hand-in-glove fit between the synoptics and John at that point. You might be able to explain one or two of these undesigned coincidences as just a happy coincidence,
coincidences. John is aware of the source material.
When you have so...
not a coincidence. He's reading the source material. He's basing his own version of stories on the source material.
When you have a cumulative body of evidence from lots of these undesigned coincidences, it becomes...
Richard's making the claim that these are simply not undesigned coincidences, I suppose. Saying this, if John makes sense of two passages, it's because he's read the two passages and he's consciously made sense of them. I mean, I guess what I'm what you need to answer, Jonathan, is why doesn't this have the flavor of John simply reconciling stuff in his account by looking at, you know, Matthew and Luke and Mark, or whoever he's got in front of him.
Because under that, you would expect him to mention this is taking place in Bethsaida, or to mention that, by the way, Philip's from Bethsaida. But you've got these this scattered across different parts of the source material, and that's something which is more expected, I think, on the hypothesis of history than it is on the hypothesis of fiction.
I disagree. I don't think it matters to John. I don't think it's important to John that he convey to you what city it was in. Like that's not a relevant detail to him. He's getting the idea of what characters to use based on the source material, but it's not going to occur to him that, oh, I better mention. So historians 2,000 years from now know what city I'm talking about. That's not how he's crafting his stories. That's not his goal.
We're going to take we're not just going to take a break. We're going to come to the end of today's program, which is a shame because there's lots more we could get into.
Yes,
and maybe we could do it another day. But it's been really interesting. Thank you very much both for being on the program today. If people want to find out more about your work, Richard, where should they look?
Everything is at richardcarrier.info. That's .info. I teach online classes on history and philosophy. I have books. I have a blog. My Twitter and Facebook accounts can be reached and followed through my blog at richardcarrier.info.
Thank you very much. Jonathan, I know that the stuff you've been talking about in terms of undesigned coincidences, a lot of which admittedly in this context is hard to take in because there's lots of detail and that and the other happened. But I know that you're drawing a lot there on the work of Tim and Lydia McGrew.
That's right, yeah.
What's the availability? What have they written in this area, just for interested listeners?
So the book that Lydia came out with last year was called Hidden in Plain View, Undesigned Coincidences in the Gospels and Acts, which is basically taking William Paley's work and also the work of J.J. Blunt into the 21st century in view of modern scholarship. So that's a resource I would recommend checking out. There's the blog of Lydia McGrew, which is What's Wrong with the World. I think it's .com or .org. You can check that out. Those would be the resources I'd point people to.
Great. And in terms of your where people can find you, there's obviously apologetics-academy.org, mm-hmm. is it? Obviously, there's lots of other material out there if you're looking for Jesus scholarship. But thank you very much for being on the program again
this week.
Jonathan. And thanks to you, Richard, for coming on the line.
Yeah.
All the very best. Great to have you both on the program today. Be interested in hearing what you thought of our exchange on this whole question, which went in lots of different directions on whether Paul believed in a real or a celestial Jesus. Let me know what you think. I'll be giving out the ways to get in touch in just a short moment's time. But for now, thanks again to my guests, Jonathan and Richard.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Do look forward to hearing what you thought about today's programme. Email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also send your thoughts via social media. @UnbelievableJB is the Twitter account to follow the show. Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the show Facebook page. And you can also see the various things I post up there on a regular basis. And if you're interested in generally the idea of the historicity of Jesus, the case for Christ, how Christianity stacks up against other religions, then you won't want to miss the Christ is the Answer seminar stream going on at Unbelievable, the conference 2018 on the 19th of May. We're going to have a whole range of speakers across the whole conference, but in that particular seminar stream, we'll be looking at Finding Christ in a Suffering World with Sharon Dirks. A Christ-like Response to Islam, Glenn Scrivener and Andy Bannister will both be presenting on Islam. And If Krishna and Buddha Met Christ, Ken Samples from Reasons to Believe, our conference partner this year, will be talking about Eastern and New Age beliefs and what we make of Christ in relation to them. So loads of great stuff. That's just a small smattering, really, of what's on offer at this year's conference. Do get yourself booked in at the early bird price, only available till the 16th of March. So go to our website, premier.org.uk/justask. I had an email in from Martin, who's an atheist who listens to the show. He's a psychologist as well, and says, I'm assuming you've come across Professor Jordan B. Peterson from the University of Toronto. I know he's in London in May as part of his book tour. Would you consider inviting him on your show? Even if you were to have a one-to-one with him, it would make for a great show. Well, I was able to email you back, Martin, and say, actually, we were fortunate enough to get Jordan B. Peterson in conversation with Susan Blackmore, atheist psychologist, back in January when he was over the first time promoting his book, 12 Rules for Life. And we're holding on to that to broadcast it as part of a special series called The Big Conversation from June onwards, all done for video as well as audio. So a real treat for Unbelievable listeners coming in June. We've got some other fantastic episodes already in the bag for that. Steven Pinker in debate with Nick Spencer on humanism, reason and science and whether they've replaced faith. We've also got a great, a special edition of the show looking at whether we need God to find meaning in life with atheist Derren Brown, who's a well-known magician, illusionist and mentalist here in the UK, in conversation with the Reverend Richard Coles, a well-known media personality and Christian priest here in the UK. So much good stuff accruing and more exciting shows to announce on that front in due course. Thanks to David, who gets in touch from Australia to say, I'm a Uniting Church minister out in Melbourne. My theological leanings are strongly liberal progressive. I resonate strongly with the work of Bart Ehrman and enjoy the humaneness of atheists like Michael Ruse. I'm not quite sure how I came across Unbelievable, but it was in the past couple of months, as I have to travel a considerable distance in the car. Older podcasts have been streamed regularly. It will take forever to drain the Unbelievable pond dry. I'm recommending it to my congregation. Your book is in our church library, and I'm letting my colleagues know about what a good resource you offer and a model of exploring very different convictions and honouring the guests. Great work. Thank you, David. Really, really do appreciate such encouraging emails like that one. And here's Jane Lewis, who says she absolutely loves Unbelievable. Been blessed by the practical and in-depth conversations you bring to the show, because it's shockingly hard to find people willing to engage in deep theological conversation at my age. She's 20 years old, Jane says. I'd love to hear a show about Christian behaviour. I'm running into a lot of situations in which Christians are unwilling to be corrected by biblical truth because they consider it judgmental. I know there are plenty of Christians out there who hit other Christians over the head with the Bible, correcting their doctrine in aggressive and unloving ways. But what is the best way for a Christian to point other believers to doctrinal truth? This could, of course, get into the foundational differences and similarities between denominations and age groups, but something along those lines would be so useful and relevant. As a 20-year-old, I find that my age group is the less literal, more freedom sort of group of believers. And while the Bible's certainly metaphorical and hyperbolic in places, it can become detrimental and damaging to simply pick and choose which parts are interpretable that way. So maybe something along the lines of interpretation, which parts are literal and which are not. Thanks for that suggestion, Jane. Jane got in touch via Facebook for that. Very interesting. I will see what I can do on that. Yes, so talking about how we tell other people, or how we disagree well, I suppose, on that sort of stuff. Just a quick one, though, in relation to that debate last week on intelligent design, the bacterial flagellum. Can it be explained by evolution or not? Jonathan McClatchy and Keith Fox were debating that. Paul in Cambridge says, thanks for hosting a very interesting discussion between Jonathan and Keith. Although I enjoyed many parts of the conversation, overall I felt both Jonathan and Keith were adopting a false dichotomy, where one needs to accept for the bacterial flagellum that it's the result of magic or miracle, which leads Jonathan into a morass of pseudo-scientific absurdities, or one needs to accept that the bacterial flagellum arose from unguided and unintended naturalistic steps, which leads Keith to what seems like a kind of schizophrenic pantheism, where God's both involved with everything that happens in nature but isn't responsible for any of the bad things that result from his involvement. What is the reason for accepting one or the other of these options? Why couldn't there be a naturalistic explanation for the evolution of the bacterial flagellum that God specially created? Let me offer an example. When I witnessed the birth of my son Tristan, and when I got to hold him the first time and put his tiny hand in mine, I felt God's presence and creative force. My son is a special creation, a new life knitted together by God's own hand, where no life like his life had ever existed before. This is a fact, but it's not a scientific fact. Science can't touch this. There's no measurement or observation that will identify the moment at which God brought my son into existence from nothing or reached down and tinkered with his genome. Nevertheless, I know that God made my son. God is the author of all new life. God was there working at the Big Bang when the first life came from non-life on the earth, when the first multicelled organisms emerged, at the evolution of the first human people, and at the birth of my child. This realization is consistent with Jonathan's citation of improbability. On top of improbability, the odds against a life-permitting universe seem staggering, and the probability that human life evolved among all the paths evolution could have taken is minuscule. The chances that my son Tristan could come into existence instead of someone else, someone slightly different than, but not definitively not him, is infinitesimal. All of these improbabilities suggest to me that God brought forth each of these events, but none of these improbabilities prohibit there also being a satisfying scientific explanation. Cosmologists have worked out out many details of the Big Bang model. Evolution provides a good explanation for multicellular life and the origin of the human species. The origin of life itself is still a mystery, but one that I and many other scientists are working on, and which I suspect will be solved within my lifetime. The biology involved with conception, gestation, and birth of my son is well understood. All this leaves me wondering, why don't we embrace both? That God specially creates all new life and is imminently involved in everything that is good and new and beautiful in the world, while at the same time trying to find out how God went about his work. The beauty and elegance in scientific explanations only add to God's subtle intelligence and creativity. These explanations take nothing from his power. Thank you, Paul. Thanks to everyone who's been in touch about the programme, and I will try to read some more of your thoughts on the intelligent design debate of last week on next week's programme. For the moment, thank you for being with me on the show today. Coming up next, Sam Hales is speaking to Chip Kendall on The Profile.
You're unbelievable.
And if you can come back for Unbelievable at the same time next week, we'll be talking about petitionary prayer. How does it work? Author of Divine Echoes, Mark Karras, is going to be talking about reconciling prayer with the uncontrolling love of God. He says we need to rethink prayer. Steve Jeffrey will be in conversation with him, presenting a more Calvinist view of prayer. Come back at the same time next week. Until then, have a good week. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Podbean, or any other podcasting software, and find out more about our other Premier podcasts at premier.org.uk/podcasts.